You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is JNYGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At last week's City Council meeting on Tuesday, June 3rd, Council reviewed a report outlining the relevant changes proposed through controversial Provincial Bills 5 and 17 and their anticipated impacts on Kingston. Both construction-focused bills officially made their way through Queen's Park last week. Bill 5, the Protect Ontario by Unleashing Our Economy Act, proposes amendments to several pieces of legislation, including the Ontario Heritage Act and a repeal of the Endangered Species Act. Council already voted unanimously to oppose Bill 5 in their May 23rd meeting, with the concern that waiting for this information report from staff would not leave enough time for MPs and relevant parties to receive the motion and take action. Chief concerns revolved around environmental impact, special economic zones that would supersede the municipality's planning power in selected areas, and opposition from Indigenous communities. Bill 17, Protect Ontario by Building Faster and Smarter Act, was put forward with the objective of speeding up the construction of new homes and infrastructure and proposes changes to streamline development approvals. This includes changes to the Building Code Act, Development Charges Act, and the Planning Act, among other legislation. The 16-page report from city staff outlined some of the key changes that will impact the city. Bill 17 will allow developers a longer time frame to pay development charges, DCs, which are used by the city to fund other infrastructure-related projects. The changes surrounding DCs may cause cash flow issues, according to the report, leading to additional financing costs for capital projects, increased administrative costs, and delays in capital project timing. Bill 17 would also give the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing the authority to decide which studies can be included in a complete building application, meaning municipalities could no longer require information like sun-shadow studies, wind studies, urban design studies, and lighting studies. According to the report, these assessments are often essential for evaluating whether a proposed development is compatible with the proposed area. While the report attempts to provide a detailed overview of the potential impacts on Kingston, the city's chief administrative officer, Lainey Hurdle, in responding to questions from council, acknowledged that the full implications of the legislation remain uncertain.
The current bill, there are no direct financial implications. There is strictly a delay in terms of when the payments have to be made, as well as I believe there might be an impact on interest. We expect, though, that there may be implications in the future, because when you look at the bill, there are still some elements that are to come forward at a later time. I think it will require more investigation in terms of what exactly this will look like. So I appreciate that the bill, Bill 17, has actually received approval, but there are still, I think, a number of things that need to come through in terms of regulations.
Councillor Connie Glenn summed up the bulk of concerns expressed by council members regarding the future impact of Bills 5 and 17 on the city's plans.
My take on it then is that it puts all of this significantly at risk, because instead of those mechanisms being more secure, we are being placed again in, and I think the best wording that described our relationship to the other levels of government was said at FCM this past weekend, that we are treated as a child. So, unfortunately, I think we're going to find ourselves in a very awkward situation trying to balance these things, and that unfortunately it's not going to have the intended impact of really speeding building.
I just didn't want to keep going around and around in circles on this issue. So I'm just looking for more.
That's out of order.
That's out of order. That's a dad joke. I have five kids.
That was Councillor Ryan Boehm speaking at Tuesday night's council meeting as he introduced a motion seeking more information about how the city decides when and where to build roundabouts. Last month, council approved the first major roundabout in Councillor Boehm's district in Kingston's East End to be built at a cost of $3 million. That decision came in place of installing traffic signals, which would have cost $1 million. Now, Councillor Boehm is asking for a deeper look into whether more roundabouts could be feasible around the city. His motion notes that roundabouts are becoming increasingly common in other municipalities as an alternative to traffic signals. They offer several potential benefits, including improved traffic flow, reduced emissions, slower vehicle speeds, and fewer severe collisions, contributing to both safety and sustainability goals. However, the motion also acknowledges challenges. Roundabouts require more space than traditional intersections, which can impact construction costs, property acquisition, and the surrounding area. With unanimous support from council, city staff have now been directed to prepare a report by early 2026, detailing the city's traffic control policies and outlining how roundabouts are evaluated for new and reconstructed intersections.
Short story long. Essentially, this is just looking for more information. Roundabouts definitely do have their place. We don't seem to be building a lot of them. So it was just in a conversation with staff of like to try to figure out like where that holdup may be. Is it a planning thing? Is it a money thing? Basically, it's more just trying to get more information. It does sound like going forward, we're probably going to start to see more of them in appropriate places. But this was more just to try to sort of understand from top, from beginning to end, how that whole evaluation process works. Obviously, we see them popping up in many places around us, but kind of want to understand how and when and why, and hopefully we will see more of them being built here. So that's as simple as it is. It's just looking for more information on that.
For CFRC News, this has been Christina Lori, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, June 9th, daytime high of 19 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation throughout the day. That 70% chance of rain stays consistent overnight as the temperature drops to a low of 15. Tuesday, June 10th, daytime high of 20 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud and a 40% chance of precipitation throughout the day. It's going to be a clear, beautiful night, dropping down to 13. Wednesday, June 11th, daytime high of 22 degrees and a low possibility of rainy weather in the forecast, just a 30% chance of precipitation dropping down to 16 overnight. Thursday, June 12th, a daytime high of 22 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud dropping down to 11 overnight. Moving towards Father's Day weekend, Friday, June 13th, daytime high of 21 degrees, a mix of sun and cloud going back down to 11 overnight. Saturday, June 14th, a high of 19 with cloudy conditions. Sunday, June 15th, staying consistent in that 18 to 20 degree range with a 40% chance of precipitation. Monday, June 16th, going to be a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 22, and it's going to be beautiful and sunny. Tuesday, June 15th, more sunny weather in the forecast. Daytime high of 23 with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for the temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel during the following periods. For the summer, the dates of closure are June 8th, June 15th, June 22nd, June 29th, July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th and 31st, and September 7th. It will be closed 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. The fall closure dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, and the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on those dates. Now for this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Earl, is closed until June 11th for paving operations. Berry Street, Queen 2 Colborne, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cassidy Street, Montreal to Maple, is closed until June 20th as part of the ongoing intersection improvements of Montreal and John Counter. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Lakeshore Boulevard, front to Joreen, closed until June 13th to rehabilitate the existing sanitary system. Pine Street, Division 2 Cherry, closed June 9th from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. for sewer relining. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria, closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett, is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Wortman Avenue, Lakeshore to Lakeland Point, is closed until June 13th to rehabilitate the existing sanitary system.
Now let's take a look at some community events happening around town this week. On Wednesday, Kingston Pride and drag artist Bewitched are hosting a drag makeup workshop at the Central Branch of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library from 4 to 7 p.m., open to anyone 14 and up. Just remember to bring your own makeup as supplies won't be provided. On Thursday, start the day with Stories in the Square at Springer Market Square from 10:30 to 11 a.m. Hosted by the Public Library, this free event features stories, songs, and sunshine. That evening, Art Noise is running life drawing from 6 to 8 p.m. with a live male model, and the drop-in cost is just $10. Over at Domino Theater, the dark comedic play Decrepitude Blues starts at 7:30 p.m. Tickets range from $10 to $20 and are available at the door. Folks, this show will be running until June 21st. Then from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m., head to Hotel Wolf Island for a special night of storytelling with Dave Pomfret and Martin Verrill. This event is free and celebrates the launch of Pomfret's debut novel, Lily. On Friday, join QLab Community for Craft Jam at BSE Skate Shop and Coffee Bar from 6 to 9 p.m. For $8, you'll get paint supplies and access to a cozy art night on the patio, plus drinks and mac and cheese. And if you're in the mood for singing, karaoke runs from 9 p.m. to 12:30 a.m. at the Buckle. On Saturday, get excited for some great Pride events. The Kingston Pride Community Fair runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Confederation Park, featuring local artisans, community groups, and live performances. The Pride Parade kicks off at noon from the Memorial Center and it winds its way downtown. Then at night, an evening of Pride lights up Confederation Park from 7 to 10 p.m. with a drag show featuring Perla from Canada's Drag Race and a stacked local lineup. Also on Saturday, YGK Craft Beer Fest returns to Fort Henry from 12 to 8 p.m. and general admission is $20. The Kings Court Street Festival runs from 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. with a neighborhood parade, barbecue, and live jazz. Island Talks runs at Hotel Wolf Island from 11:15 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. with author Sarah Selecki. Or folks can catch Sapphic Delights at Something in the Water from 8 to midnight with drag, games, and dancing. Tickets are $20 in advance or $25 at the door. At 10 p.m., Timeout Bar and Bistro hosts a free 19-plus drag show with Becca Blake, Tiffany Morgan, and Dixie Landers. And finally, the Forever Gala in celebration of Kingston's Animal Rescue's 15th anniversary. It's happening at the Isabel Bader Center from 5 to 11:30 p.m., with tickets available for $175 each or $325 per pair. On Sunday, the Kingston Community Brain Tumor Walk takes place at Breakwater Park. Registration starts at 10 a.m., and the walk kicks off at 11. Or check out the Brock Street Block Party, running from 12 to 4 p.m. with street shopping, games, live music, and a roaming bar between King and Wellington. And Sunday evening, Alina Ballerina's Summer Gala hits the Kingston Grand Theatre at 5:30 p.m. with performances in jazz, tap, ballet, and more. Tickets are just over $39 for adults and $33 for youth. Got a community event you'd like us to share? Head to cfrc.ca and let us know.
Hi. Hi folks, it's CFRC's Ellie Sturton, and coming up are some great live music events you can check out around town this week. On Wednesday, it's Wings and Tunes at the Covan with Sean McCullough and friends from 5 to 8 p.m. Grab some wings and join the open mic and maybe win a prize. Blues fans can catch Jeff Dunn live at Time Out Bar and Bistro from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. But if you're up for something louder, Tumble's Lost in Light tour hits Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 to 10:30 p.m. with Montreal guests Mooch. Tickets are $15 to $20. On Thursday, grab your guitar for Country Open Mic with Clem Chesterfield at the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. with a $5 cover. Or head to the Cove Inn to see the award-winning country blues legend Morgan Davis play a special solo set from 5 to 8 p.m. with a $15 cover at the door. Check out Who's Here, live at Grace United Church in Gananoque from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Tickets range from $20 to $25 and raise funds for the church's efforts. The Thousand Island Country Fest kicks off on Thursday at Happy Green Acres Campground with Abby Stewart at 7 p.m. and Lemon Cash at 9. Tickets are $39 per day or $99 for the full weekend. On Friday, the Sittin' Ducks bring classic rock and country to the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m., $5 for non-members. The Thousand Island Country Fest continues with Paige Rutledge, Dean James, and John Norrand on the bill. At 7:30 p.m., award-winning organist Nathan Avakian performs at Kingston Korean Church. Just call ahead to reserve tickets. And the Grit and Grind Fest launches on the mansion's patio at 5 p.m. with a full lineup of heavy music. Tickets are just $30 in advance. Folks can also catch Purple Diamonds at Time Out Bar and Bistro from 6 to 8 p.m. and fast forward to Friday playing at Wharf and Feather from 6 to 9 p.m. On Saturday, the Spectators play the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m. with a $5 cover for non-members. And the Thousand Islands Country Fest wraps up with music all day at Happy Green Acres featuring Lucas Oak, Mackenzie Leigh Meyer, and David Boy James, closing it out at 9 p.m. Over at the Hotel Wolf Island, Bryce Clifford and Brother Briscoe play from 6 to 9 p.m. And at Spearhead Brewery, Mauricio Montesinos performs Latin guitar from 2 to 5 p.m. Stick around at Spearhead Brewery for a fundraiser from 7 to 10 p.m. supporting Kingston's Rosewell rehearsal space. It features the Killdeers, Clem Chesterfield, and the Bon Evans Band. That one is $15 or pay what you can. And on Sunday, Gerald McGrath brings indie rock to Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5 p.m. And at Time Out Bar and Bistro, Landon Martin and John McClurg perform from 3 to 6 p.m. Got a local concert or music event you want us to share on air? Head to cfrc.ca and let us know.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter. Beat. When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter. Beat.
Banter.
Join us every Thursday at
1
on
CFRC
for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.
And you're listening to The Only Show.
Beat Banter.
On CFRC Radio.
Beat.
Banter. Banter.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by local EDM artist Yuta Monique. The new track called Is This Mind Control showcases Yuta Monique's signature blend of high-energy beats and infectious melodies. The song also captures the spirit of the genre, inviting listeners to move, connect, and get lost in the rhythm. Drawing inspiration from the values of EDM culture, including peace, love, unity, and respect, Yuta Monique's song celebrates the way music brings people of all ages, backgrounds, and identities together in a shared experience of joy and unity. Want to be highlighted next time? Completely release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Is This Mind Control by Yuta Monique on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by the Healy Brothers. The song First in Line is best described as a vibe, balancing upbeat pop energy with the emotional weight of unbalanced relationships. The track explores the longing to be more than just an option, pairing a driving rhythm with lyrics that invite both reflection and movement. Though this marks their first official release with Jaden's, the creative process flowed naturally. A late addition, the bridge and rap section brought a new level of cohesion and emotional depth. First in Line is for anyone who's ever found themselves stuck between hope and hesitation. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream First in Line by Healy Brothers on your favorite platform and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Seth W.J. Hunt's new single, Avenue B. Written during a stay in a Manhattan hotel, the track draws clear inspiration from early 2000s New York rock, particularly The Strokes with its sharp guitars and upbeat distorted rhythm. Avenue B reflects Hunt's connection to the city and tackles themes of love and having fun with friends. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Avenue B by Seth W.J. Hunt on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Cause that's who we are.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 270. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On this program, we will hear from Mohammed Khazir, who is a member of the Palestine Solidarity Collective in the UK. I thought it would be meaningful to share a spotlight on an important and interesting initiative to build solidarity with the Palestinian people in the context of the UK. Of course, London has been a center of massive solidarity demonstrations with Palestine over the last years as the Israeli state has unleashed a genocidal military assault on the people of Gaza, Palestine. And in parallel to these massive protests, there's a lot of different collectives that have launched. Mohammed is part of one. It's called the Palestine Collective, which works primarily within design and architectural spaces in the UK. And Mohammed has been really involved in this project. And I wanted to share a conversation and create a little window into a Palestine solidarity initiative in the UK. Thank you to Hazem Jimjoum for the connection. And here's my conversation with Mohammed.
So around the world in cities, there's been this unprecedented mobilization really at a grassroots level for Palestine. You're in the UK in a town just north of London, Peterborough, where you have a very strong immigrant community, many diverse diasporas. And I understand there's been a pretty significant mobilization, not just in the centers of major cities, but also in smaller cities. Maybe you could introduce yourself and speak a little bit about how you've organized in your context, why it's been important for you, and just also describe for people who are not familiar with the geography of where you are, like how it's been and how it's looked, the protests and the mobilizations.
In England, obviously, London is our capital. We have, you know, we've had huge demonstrations in London. And my name's Mohammed Khazir. I helped set up the Palestine Collective in October 2023. And really, our aim is quite specific. It's to try and normalize support for Palestine in the architectural, design, creative, and academic industries. So we are a collective of creatives and, you know, some of the most talented people I've ever met. And we realized that when October the 7th happened and the events, you know, since, people in design industries, in architectural industry and academia especially, were somewhat silenced and somewhat scared to speak out. I actually have a personal kind of memory. I lecture at the University of Sheffield, and I went to speak to one of the staff members about, you know, the Palestine Collective, because he was actually one of my lecturers when I studied at Sheffield. And he was all about radical decolonization. So I thought, well, he's the perfect guy to talk about the events going on today in Palestine. And at the moment I started talking about the topic, he sort of said, you know, asked me to close the door behind him so no one else could hear. you know, because he was worried what would happen about, you know, to his job, to his work, if people knew he was talking about this. Now, this felt very strange to me because in England, you know, we have, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And it felt like the first time in my life, you know, where this was an issue now. You know, we couldn't talk openly about a genocide happening in real time. And I studied, you know, I remember studying history GCSE, you know, the mantra that was kind of drummed into us was any Holocaust must not happen again, you know, and we must speak up, you know, and so it felt like, well, here's a real life situation. Here are these lecturers and academics that I revere, and they are, you know, not through no fault of their own, but they are sort of silenced from speaking. That was the provocation for setting up the collective, is in our space, which is quite a small kind of community, you know, the architectural, the design community. How can we in our community do something where we can normalize support for Palestine? And so that was the idea behind it. You talk about sort of organizing, and the way we've organized ourselves has really been digital. We've done, you know, we hold meetings and we have people from all over the country joining. We've had a lot of our events mainly in London. We've got some events we're planning now in Birmingham, which is, for people who aren't fully aware of the UK, slightly more west of the country. London is sort of southeast. Our flagship event that happened was we had a collaboration with, after about 8 months of us being together, planning events, doing talks around England, around London, holding space for people to talk about Palestine, we were able to secure a collaboration with the London Festival of Architecture, which runs for a month in around June time. Now, this was a big thing because this somewhat legitimized us as a collective and our mission, and it gave us a huge amount of confidence. And for 2 days, we held an exhibition in London where members of the design community, the architectural community, came and witnessed our exhibition on the domesticity of Palestine. So this was, for us, a huge confidence boost, one of our most flagship moments, I suppose, and the amount of interest we had in those 2 days secured for us that what we were doing was really important. And people were crying out for that kind of a space to express what they're feeling without being judged.
So in terms of flipping narratives on their head, a lot of what's happened this last year is on the streets. It's in person. Of course, like you mentioned, technologies of communication, like online meetings and social media, has played a role. But the push and pull of actually being in the city spaces, within, you know, institutional spaces, and pushing out and really creating space for Palestine has been really important in the UK. And I'm thinking about the ways that the mass protests in London actually successfully pushed back. They had tried to really halt them, right? And this is a pretty significant, I think, moment that I feel needs to be underlined, is talking about how people successfully were able to take the streets despite the repression, right? And that was over a few of different examples, different dates. One of them was quote-unquote Remembrance Day in the fall of 2023. But I know that there was others where there was this attempt to really silence the groundswell of mobilization in the center of London, where people were coming from different municipalities really to show this mass opposition to genocide in Palestine.
Yeah, exactly, Stefan. And, you know, we went to a few of these rallies, these protests ourselves. They were absolutely immense, and they were just wonderful. There was sort of, you know, there's one wonderful atmosphere, you know, and we really felt like we were together in this cause. So yeah, absolutely, I agree.
But I don't think that people get a sense of how difficult it was to actually refuse the attempts to silence those protests, right? Like yourselves and others, a lot of people actually decided to go back and to challenge the demands from government authorities at the highest level, who are saying, don't come out on the streets. But hundreds of thousands of people did. Can you talk about why that was important for you and also for society more generally in terms of diaspora communities taking space?
Yeah, we did have that. There was a period, a significant few months where British politicians were speaking out against this. And there was a lot of polarization in British politics, in British media about the situation, you know, trying to make it an us and them situation. You know, for example, you remember you mentioned Remembrance Day, you know, and that narrative seemed to feed into this idea of extremes, you know, that these guys are against us, they're against British values, which absolutely is not the case. You know, British values are, you know, the freedom of expression and the freedom of protest. So I suppose I can only speak for myself, but my own feeling in regards to this was that, the number of people at a very kind of physical base level is, you know, it's not something that can really be it's hard to resist, let's say. And B, you know, just that the point of, you know, a fundamental right of a British citizen is their freedom of expression. And, you know, so I think those values kind of won out in the end. And I think people in England are pretty clued on. You know, I think everyone, I mean, I've actually never met anyone who disputes the horrors that are going on. You know, there's no one that really disagrees that what's going on is wrong, is abhorrent, on a public level, you know. So it really is from an institutional level or a governmental level where these rules are being imposed on academics, architects, creatives, even obviously outside of these industries. That's my view on it.
Well, it's also seems to be mirrored in other places, which is, you know, these sort of quote unquote values of, you know, being out to express yourself is allowed for some and not for others, right? And that pushback, the challenge, limitations on, you know, people's ability to speak up for Palestine was really important. And I know that happened also in other fields, and you've talked about your work in architecture and the academic institutions. So speak a little bit more about why sort of pushing out and creating space, for example, at London Architecture Week and other contexts was important for you, and to say the words Palestine and talk also about the geography of occupation, the geography of genocide. I mean, there is a very specific plan in terms of reprogramming territory. And that's, of course, linked to colonial frameworks, the Israeli state. But that's, you know, also tied to other colonial histories. If we're thinking about the subcontinent, if we're thinking about, you know, British colonialism in Kenya, South Africa, you know, these patterns and sort of processes are not unique, and they're tied to a whole history. So anything you'd like to say about that?
Yeah, you're right, Stefan. And, you know, just to say that when we set up the collective, we were quite conscious of this polarizing, of how polarizing this event seemed to make people. And we were very keen to not partake in that kind of conversation. For example, Hazem, who was one of our speakers, absolutely brilliant speaker. We actually hosted an event around one of his presentations, which was kind of like the A to Z of Zionism, you know, the history of Zionism. And it was incredibly factual. You know, there was no emotive or political swing to his talk, you know. And that's something we aim to do with our events. We don't want to switch people off who may have, for whatever reason, been miscommunicated by the media, by the British media or online, that what Israel is doing is in any way justifiable. To combat that kind of perception that people may have, it's incredibly important to listen to them. So, you know, we're talking about freedom of speech. You know, as much as it's our right to speak for what we believe in, we have to accept that everyone has their point of view, and that even if they are not believing in the same way we're believing, you know, they may, for whatever reason, have the wrong information and be not as sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, it's our job to not to switch them off or to have a kind of knee-jerk reaction to that. It's our job to be incredibly good listeners and be patient in communicating our point of view. And in that way, people who may be sitting on the fence or maybe on the other side, which is a weird thing to say because we're talking about polarization, but that does seem to be the reality, they are more likely to, you know, listen to us and engage with us. And so that's how we try and curate our events.
So about the events and the process that you're a part of, name again your collective and just speak a little bit more about, you know, the space that you're trying to create in this project, through this project.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are the Palestine Collective. We set up in October 2023, and the space we're trying to create is within, specifically within architecture and design industries, and trying to remind people of this value of freedom of expression, to stand up for what's right. And the way we do that is every sort of 2 or 3 months, you know, by the way, we're all kind of students, people who've just finished university, people who've just entered the workforce. So we've got our kind of jobs and things going on in the background, you know, so we do this as and when we can. But this was our way to express our frustration. We have people in the collective who, in their professions, their workplaces were refusing to speak about this issue. And they felt isolated. So we have kind of, it seems like we're sort of this group of individuals who does feel a bit frustrated about that, about the way that people are not willing to engage in this conversation. So the way we manifest that really is every 2 to 3 months we have been holding events. Some of them have been lectures, some talks. We have like a lecture series going on. We have a brilliant graphic designer, Victoria, who hopefully you'll get to speak to eventually, Stefan, but she unfortunately couldn't be at this interview today. But she, you know, we've got people like Barrera and Lucy, these amazing, amazingly talented individuals who are helping, you know, we're just ordinary people. We're just trying to facilitate a space where people can come to these events and talk openly. And to be honest, Stefan, it wasn't something we consciously were aware of when we set up our first talk. Our first talk was hosted at the London School of Architecture, and we just, you know, had never organized a talk before. So we did our best. We invited people. We got like an Eventbrite. We set up an Instagram, all that stuff. We got 100 people to come down, which is amazing. And we realized that it was actually the bit before the talk and the bit slightly after the talk where people were mingling that a lot of these conversations were taking place. And people had come down who were just curious, but they weren't necessarily for or against, but they were just curious about what was going on. And they wanted to hear someone else's perspective. And it was those conversations that we realized, wow, our events, yes, we have the flagship speaker, the, you know, but actually it's the moment before and the moment after, the Q&A, where people get a chance to really exchange ideas, and we get to really talk to people, and they feel like this is, it feels like a little bit of a family, you know, not to get too sentimental about it, but it feels like a little bit of a family. You know, we can all talk about this, and we usually have like bake sales, we usually have food and stuff like this, and it really becomes quite a nice festive atmosphere.
So your work is focused around architecture and design. And I think it's important to just name that there is an element around architecture and architecture of occupation, the architecture of the military-industrial complex of the Israeli state that's playing out in Palestine. Do you have anything to share about this?
Yeah. So of course, the situation we're seeing, you know, is a situation where we're seeing the mass, obviously the mass destruction of life, but also the erasure of space and the erasure of a culture and a heritage. And all of these themes are sort of linked, you know, geography, the geography of Palestine. And so when we have our talks, when we have our exhibitions, these are inherent. I mean, it's inherent, isn't it? I suppose in occupation that these things are violated, you know, these sacred things are violated. And so that it's sort of become inherent. There's been a very strong element of that in our events, but really, I think what we've really hit on is we simply want to make that space to have those conversations. And our sort of end goal really is to get some reaction from the Royal Institute of British Architects, for example, who we have been, you know, communicating with and trying to make something happen there. So what I'm saying is we're trying to go from, we're trying to really reach for the institutions that are imposing this sort of censorship, let's call it that, and we're really trying to break that paradigm. That's what we're trying to do. If people can speak openly and freely about what's going on and not feel ostracized, then you know that is a dream of mine. You know, if it's something we can have some way of having an effect on that dynamic.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak today, Mohammed.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you so much.
That was a conversation with Mohammed Khazir of the Palestine Collective in the UK. You can learn more about them. Just look up Palestine Collective on social media. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. On CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. On CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. On CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. On CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. On CKCU, 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And now on CJSF, 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Just look us up, search Free City Radio on your favorite podcast platform. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.